Chapter 3. Back at home, my mother seemed to have grown sicker in the day I'd been away, or perhaps it was just that I'd managed to forget how ill she really was. Mr. Tanaka's house had smelled of smoke and pine, but ours smelled of the illness in a way I can't even bear to describe. Satsu was working in the village during the afternoon, so Mrs. Sugi came to help me bathe my mother. When we carried her out of the house, her rib cage was broader than her shoulders, and even the whites of her eyes were cloudy. I could only endure seeing her this way by remembering how I'd once felt stepping out of the bath with her while she was strong and healthy, when the steam had risen from our pale skin as if we were two pieces of boiled radish. I found it hard to imagine that this woman, whose back I'd so often scraped with a stone, and whose flesh had always seemed firmer and smoother to me than Satsu's, might be dead before even the end of summer. That night, while lying on my futon, I tried to picture the whole confusing situation from every angle to persuade myself that things would somehow be all right. To begin with, I wondered, how could we go on living without my mother? Even if we did survive and Mr. Tanaka adopted us, would my own family cease to exist? Finally, I decided Mr. Tanaka wouldn't adopt just my sister and me, but my father as well. He couldn't expect my father to live alone, after all. Usually, I couldn't fall asleep until I'd managed to convince myself this was true, with the result that I didn't sleep much during those weeks, and mornings were a blur. On one of these mornings during the heat of the summer, I was on my way back from fetching a packet of tea in the village when I heard a crunching noise behind me. It turned out to be Mr. Sugi, Mr. Tanaka's assistant, running up the path. When he reached me, he took a long while to catch his breath, huffing and holding his side, as if he'd just run all the way from Senzuru. He was red and shiny like a snapper, though the day hadn't grown hot yet. Finally, he said, "Mr. Tanaka wants you and your sister to come down to the village as soon as you can." I thought it odd that my father hadn't gone out fishing that morning. Now I knew why. Today was the day. "And my father?" I asked. "Did Mr. Tanaka say anything about him?"
"Just get along, Chiyu-chan," he told me. "Go and fetch your sister."
I didn't like this, but I ran up to the house and found my father sitting at the table, digging grime out of a rut in the wood with one of his fingernails. Satsu was putting slivers of coal into the stove. It seemed as though the two of them were waiting for something horrible to happen. I said, "Father, Mr. Tanaka wants Satsu-san and me to go down to the village." Satsu took off her apron, hung it on a peg, and walked out the door. My father didn't answer but blinked a few times, staring at the point where Satsu had been. Then he turned his eyes heavily toward the floor and gave a nod. I heard my mother cry out in her sleep from the back room. Satsu was almost to the village before I caught up with her. I'd imagined this day for weeks already, but I'd never expected to feel as frightened as I did. Satsu didn't seem to realize this trip to the village was any different from one she might have made the day before. She hadn't even bothered to clean the charcoal off her hands. While wiping her hair away, she ended up with a smudge on her face. I didn't want her to meet Mr. Tanaka in this condition, so I reached up to rub off the mark as our mother might have done. Satsu knocked my hand away. Outside the Japan Coastal Seafood Company, I bowed and said good morning to Mr. Tanaka, expecting he would be happy to see us. Instead, he was strangely cold. I suppose this should have been my first clue that things weren't going to happen just the way I'd imagined. When he led us to his horse-drawn wagon, I decided he probably wanted to drive us to his house so that his wife and daughter would be in the room when he told us about our adoption.
"Mr. Sugi will be riding in the front with me," he said, "so you and Shizu-san had better get into the back."
That's just what he said, Shizu-san. I thought it very rude of him to get my sister's name wrong that way, but she didn't seem to notice. She climbed into the back of the wagon and sat down among the empty fish baskets, putting one of her hands flat onto the slimy planks. And then, with that same hand, she wiped the fly from her face,
leaving a shiny patch on her cheek. I didn't feel as indifferently about the slime as Satsu did. I couldn't think about anything but the smell, and about how satisfied I would feel to wash my hands and perhaps even my clothes when we reached Mr. Tanaka's house. During the trip, Satsu and I didn't speak a word, until we topped the hill overlooking Senzuru, when all of a sudden she said, "A train." I looked out to see a train in the distance, making its way toward the town. The smoke rolled downward in a way that made me think of the skin being shed from a snake. I thought this was clever and tried explaining it to Satsu, but she didn't seem to care. Mr. Tanaka would have appreciated it, I thought, and so would Kuniko. I decided to explain it to both of them when we reached the Tanaka's home. Then suddenly, I realized we weren't heading in the direction of Mr. Tanaka's home at all. The wagon came to a stop a few minutes later on a patch of dirt beside the train tracks just outside the town. A crowd of people stood with sacks and crates piled around them. And there, to one side of them, was Mrs. Fidget, standing beside a peculiarly narrow man wearing a stiff kimono. He had soft black hair, like a cat's, and held in one of his hands a cloth bag suspended from a string. He struck me as out of place in Senzuru, particularly there beside the farmers and the fishermen with their crates and an old hunched woman wearing a rucksack of yams. Mrs. Fidget said something to him, and when he turned and peered at us, I decided at once that I was frightened of him. Mr. Tanaka introduced us to this man, whose name was Beku. Mr. Beku said nothing at all, but only looked closely at me and seemed puzzled by Satsu. Mr. Tanaka said to him, "I've brought Sugi with me from Yoroido. Would you like him to accompany you? He knows the girls, and I can spare him for a day or so." "No, no," said Mr. Beku, waving his hand. I certainly hadn't expected any of this. I asked where we were going, but no one seemed to hear me, so I came up with an answer for myself. I decided Mr. Tanaka had been displeased by what Mrs. Fidget had told him about us, and that this curiously narrow man, Mr. Beku, planned to take us somewhere to have our fortunes told more completely. Afterward, we would be returned to Mr. Tanaka. While I tried my best to soothe myself with these thoughts, Mrs. Fidget, wearing a pleasant smile, led Satsu and me some distance down the dirt platform. When we were too far away for the others to hear us, her smile vanished, and she said, "Now listen to me. You're both naughty girls." She looked around, to be sure no one was watching, and then hit us on the tops of our heads. She didn't hurt me, but I cried out in surprise. "If you do something to embarrass me," she went on, "I'll make you pay for it. Mr. Beku is a stern man. You must pay attention to what he says. If he tells you to crawl under the seat of the train, you'll do it. Understand?" From the expression on Mrs. Fidget's face, I knew I should answer her, or she might hurt me. But I was in such shock I couldn't speak. And then, just as I'd feared, she reached out and began pinching me so hard on the side of my neck that I couldn't even tell which part of me hurt. I felt as if I'd fallen into a tub of creatures that were biting me everywhere, and I heard myself whimper. The next thing I knew, Mr. Tanaka was standing beside us. "What's going on here?" he said. "If you have something more to say to these girls, say it while I'm standing here. There's no cause for you to treat them this way." "I'm sure we have a great many more things to talk about, but the train is coming," Mrs. Fidget said. And it was true. I could see it curling around a turn not far in the distance. Mr. Tanaka led us back up the platform to where the farmers and old women were gathering up their things. Soon, the train came to a stop before us. Mr. Beku, in his stiff kimono, wedged himself between Satsu and me and led us by our elbows into the train car. I heard Mr. Tanaka say something, but I was too confused and upset to understand it. I couldn't trust what I heard. It might have been, "Matayo, we'll meet again," or this, "Matayo, wait," or even this, "Madeo, well, let's go." When I peered out the window, I saw Mr. Tanaka walking back toward his cart and Mrs. Fidget wiping her hands all over her kimono. After a moment, my sister said, "Chiyu-chan!" I buried my face in my hands, and honestly, I would have plunged in anguish through the floor of the train if I could have, because the way my sister said my name, she hardly needed to say anything more.
"Do you know where we're going?"
she said to me. I think all she wanted was a yes or no answer. Probably it didn't matter to her what our destination was, so long as someone knew what was happening. But of course I didn't. I asked the narrow man, Mr. Baku, but he paid no attention to me. He was still staring at Satsu as if he had never seen anything like her before. Finally, he squeezed his face into a look of disgust and said, "Fish, what a stench, the both of you." He took a comb from his drawstring bag and began tearing it through her hair. I'm certain he must have hurt her, but I could see that watching the countryside pass by outside the window hurt her even more. In a moment, Satsu's lips turned down like a baby's, and she began to cry. Even if she'd hit me and yelled at me, I wouldn't have ached as much as I did watching her whole face tremble. Everything was my fault. An old peasant woman with her teeth bared like a dog's came over with a carrot for Satsu, and after giving it to her, asked where she was going. "Kyoto," Mr. Baku answered. I felt so sick with worry at hearing this, I couldn't bring myself to look Satsu in the eye any longer. Even the town of Senzuru seemed a remote, faraway place. As for Kyoto, it sounded as foreign to me as Hong Kong or even New York, which I'd once heard Dr. Miura talk about. For all I knew, they ground up children in Kyoto and fed them to dogs. We were on that train for many hours without food to eat. The sight of Mr. Baku taking a wrapped-up lotus leaf from his bag and unwrapping it to reveal a rice ball sprinkled with sesame seeds certainly got my attention. But when he took it in his bony fingers and pressed it into his mean little mouth without so much as looking at me, I felt as if I couldn't take another moment of torment. We got off the train at last in a large town, which I took to be Kyoto, but after a time, another train pulled into the station and we boarded it. This one did take us to Kyoto. It was much more crowded than the first train had been, so that we had to stand. By the time we arrived, as evening was approaching, I felt as sore as a rock must feel when the waterfall has pounded on it all day long. I could see little of the city as we neared Kyoto Station. But then, to my astonishment, I caught a glimpse of rooftops reaching as far as the base of hills in the distance. I could never have imagined a city so huge. Even to this day, the sight of streets and buildings from a train often makes me remember the terrible emptiness and fear I felt on that curious day when I first left my home. Back then, around 1930, a fair number of rickshaws still operated in Kyoto. In fact, so many were lined up before the station that I imagined no one went anywhere in this big city unless it was in a rickshaw, which couldn't have been further from the truth. Perhaps 15 or 20 of them sat pitched forward onto their poles, with their drivers squatting nearby, smoking or eating. Some of the drivers even lay curled up asleep, right there in the filth of the street. Mr. Baku led us by our elbows again, as if we were a couple of buckets he was bringing back from the well. He probably thought I'd have run away if he'd let go of me a moment, but I wouldn't have. Wherever he was taking us, I preferred it to being cast out alone into that great expanse of streets and buildings, as foreign to me as the bottom of the sea. We climbed into a rickshaw with Mr. Baku squeezed tightly on the bench between us. He was a good deal bonier under that kimono, even than I suspected. We pitched back as the driver raised the poles, and then Mr. Baku said, "Tominagacho, in Gion." The driver said nothing in reply, but gave the rickshaw a tug to get it moving and then set off at a trot. After a block or two, I worked up my courage and said to Mr. Baku, "Won't you please tell us where we're going?" He didn't look as if he would reply, but after a moment he said, "To your new home." At this, my eyes filled with tears. I heard Satsu weeping on the other side of Mr. Baku, and was just about to let out a sob of my own when Mr. Baku suddenly struck her. and she let out a loud gasp. I bit my lip and stopped myself so quickly from crying any further that I think the tears themselves may have come to a halt as they slid down my cheeks. Soon we turned onto an avenue that seemed as broad as the whole village of Yoroido. I could hardly see the other side for all the people, bicycles, cars, and trucks. I'd never seen a car before. I'd seen photographs, but I remember being surprised at how, well, cruel the way they looked to me in my frightened state, as though they were designed more to hurt people than to help them. All my senses were assaulted. Trucks rumbled past so close I could smell the scorched rubber odor of their tires. I heard a horrible screech, which turned out to be a streetcar on tracks in the center of the avenue. I felt terrified as evening settled in around us, but I was never so astonished by anything in my life as by my first glimpse of city lights. I'd never even seen electricity except during part of our dinner at Mr. Tanaka's house. Here, windows were lit along the buildings upstairs and down, and the people on the sidewalk stood under puddles of yellow glow. I could see pinpoints even at the far reaches of the avenue. We turned onto another street, and I saw for the first time the Minamisa Theater standing on the opposite side of the bridge ahead of us. Its tiled roof was so grand, I thought it was a palace. At length, the rickshaw turned down an alleyway of wooden houses. The way they were all packed together, they seemed to share one continuous facade, which once again gave me the terrible feeling of being lost. I watched women in kimono rushing around in a great hurry on the little street. They looked very elegant to me, though, as I later learned, they were mostly maids. When we came to a halt before a doorway, Mr. Beku instructed me to get out. He climbed out behind me, and then, as if the day hadn't been difficult enough, the worst thing of all happened. For when Satsu tried to get out as well, Mr. Beku turned and pushed her back with his long arm. "Stay there," he said to her. "You're going elsewhere." I looked at Satsu, and Satsu looked at me. It may have been the first time we'd ever completely understood each other's feelings, but it lasted only a moment, for the next thing I knew, my eyes had welled up with tears so much I could scarcely see. I felt myself being dragged backward by Mr. Beku. I heard women's voices and quite a bit of commotion. I was on the point of throwing myself onto the street when suddenly Satsu's mouth fell open at something she saw in the doorway behind me. I was in a narrow entryway with an ancient-looking well on one side and a few plants on the other. Mr. Beku had dragged me inside, and now he pulled me up onto my feet. There, on the step of the entryway, just slipping her feet into her lacquered zori, stood an exquisitely beautiful woman wearing a kimono lovelier than anything I'd ever imagined. I'd been impressed with the kimono worn by the young buck-toothed geisha in Mr. Tanaka's village of Senzuru, but this one was a water blue with swirling lines in ivory to mimic the current in a stream. Glistening silver trout tumbled in the current, and the surface of the water was ringed with gold wherever the soft green leaves of a tree touched it. I had no doubt the gown was woven of pure silk, and so was the obi, embroidered in pale greens and yellows. And her clothing wasn't the only extraordinary thing about her. Her face was painted a kind of rich white, like the wall of a cloud when lit by the sun. Her hair, fashioned into lobes, gleamed as darkly as lacquer, and was decorated with ornaments carved out of amber and with a bar from which tiny silver strips dangled, shimmering as she moved. This was my first glimpse of Hatsumomo. At the time, she was one of the most renowned geisha in the district of Gion, though, of course, I didn't know any of this then. She was a petite woman. The top of her hairstyle reached no higher than Mr. Beku's shoulder. I was so startled by her appearance that I forgot my manners, not that I had developed very good manners yet, and stared directly at her face. She was smiling at me, though not in a kindly way. And then she said, "Mr. Beku, could you take out the garbage later? I'd like to be on my way." There was no garbage in the entryway. She was talking about me. Mr. Beku said he thought Hatsumomo had enough room to pass. "You may not mind being so close to her," said Hatsumomo. But when I see filth on one side of the street, I cross to the other. Suddenly, an older woman, tall and knobby, like a bamboo pole, appeared in the doorway behind her.
I don't know how anyone puts up with you, Hatsumomo-san, said the woman,
but she gestured for Mr. Baku to pull me onto the street again, which he did. After this, she stepped down into the entryway very awkwardly, for one of her hips jutted out and made it difficult for her to walk, and crossed to a tiny cabinet on the wall. She took from it something that looked to me like a piece of flint, along with a rectangular stone, like the kind fishermen use to sharpen their knives, and then stood behind Hatsumomo and struck the flint against the stone, causing a little cluster of sparks to jump onto Hatsumomo's back. I didn't understand this at all, but you see, geishas are more superstitious even than fishermen. A geisha will never go out for the evening until someone has sparked a flint on her back for good luck. After this, Hatsumomo walked away, using such tiny steps that she seemed to glide along the bottom of her kimono, fluttering just a bit. I didn't know that she was a geisha at the time, for she was worlds above the creature I'd seen in Senzuru a few weeks earlier. I decided she must be some sort of stage performer. We all watched her float away, and then Mr. Baku handed me over to the older woman in the entryway. He climbed back into the rickshaw with my sister, and the driver raised the poles. But I never saw them leave, because I was slumped down in the entryway in tears. The older woman must have taken pity on me. For a long while I lay there, sobbing in my misery, without anyone touching me. I even heard her shush up a maid who came from inside the house to speak with her. At length, she helped me to my feet and dried my face with a handkerchief she took from one sleeve of her simple gray kimono.
"Now, now, little girl. There's no need to worry so. No one's going to cook you."
She spoke with the same peculiar accent as Mr. Baku and Hatsumomo. It sounded so different from the Japanese spoken in my village that I had a hard time understanding her, but in any case, hers were the kindest words anyone had said to me all day, so I made up my mind to do what she advised. She told me to call her Auntie, and then she looked down at me square in the face and said in a throaty voice,
"Heavens, what startling eyes! You're a lovely girl, aren't you? Mother will be thrilled."
I thought at once that the mother of this woman, whoever she was, must be very old, because Auntie's hair, knotted tightly at the back of her head, was mostly gray, with only streaks of black remaining. Auntie led me through the doorway, where I found myself standing on a dirt corridor, passing between two closely spaced structures, to a courtyard in the back. One of the structures was a little dwelling like my house in Yoroido, two rooms with floors of dirt. It turned out to be the maid's quarters. The other was a small, elegant house, sitting up on foundation stones in such a way that a cat might have crawled underneath it. The corridor between them opened onto the dark sky above, which gave me the feeling I was standing in something more like a miniature village than a house, especially since I could see several other small wooden buildings down in the courtyard at the end. I didn't know it at the time, but this was a very typical dwelling for the section of Kyoto in which it stood. The buildings in the courtyard, though they gave the impression of another group of tiny houses, were just a small shed for the toilets and a storehouse of two levels with a ladder on the outside. The entire dwelling fitted into an area smaller than Mr. Tanaka's home in the countryside and housed only 8 people, or rather 9, now that I had arrived.